diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show.
We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which looks at the future of the corporation by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, we were looking at the chapter, A Broader Agenda. In late 2000, the pressures on the Ford Motor Company showed that running a big multinational company may be too much for one person. Because of the crisis surrounding faulty Firestone tires, Ford faced a serious setback in its vision and reputation as a consumer products company and good global citizen. Its U.S. businesses were losing profitability and might even have more difficulties because of the fallout from the Ford Firestone ordeal. Its European operations were hemorrhaging cash for reasons as yet unrelated to the recall. Its intention to purchase Daewoo Motors in South Korea had to be put aside because the entire array of pressures on top management in Detroit, thereby undercutting its Asian strategy. Surely, these challenges would require all of the efforts of both the chairman, who might have been best positioned to deal with the political and social issues, and the CEO, who was needed to attend to the company's core operations. Admittedly, Ford faced an extreme situation, but every global company had to be prepared for at least one big crisis. After all, that's when its leadership is tested and its reputation hangs in the balance. Nancy Peretzman of Allen & Company muses that particularly for high-technology companies, the jobs of chairman and CEO may need to be separated. What we've seen is that certain founders, or those with a large financial stake in the company, are turning over day-to-day management of the growth to partners so that they can focus on strategic positioning. Particularly at a time when so many rules are changing, someone's got to be paying attention to where the business needs to be, and then someone has to be running the hypergrowth of the business. In this model, the chairman's vision could include a company's relationship and involvement in broader social issues. Peretzman may be identifying a strong trend, but in recent years, even the most powerful and successful chief executives have opted for a strong partner. In late 1999, for example, Bill Gates made Steve Ballmer CEO, with all the responsibility for Microsoft's day-to-day operations. In mid-2000, Louis Gretzner promoted Samuel Palmisano to the vacant position of President and Chief Operating Officer of IBM to be in charge of daily operations, and designated John Thompson to become Vice Chairman for the new growth area. Over the last several months, Michael Dell has turned over most day-to-day oversight to two vice chairmen, Kevin Rollins and James Vanderslice. A second way for business leaders to be better able to shoulder the job of running their companies and broadening responsibilities for the global economy is for their associations to evolve beyond the narrow lobbying groups they now are, for new ones that are to be devised. A good example of a business organization that has fallen significantly short of its potential is the Business Roundtable, which was established in 1972 as an association of U.S. chief executives committed to advocating public policies for the U.S. economy. According to its charter, the Roundtable was designed to enable CEOs representing different sectors of the economy, manufacturing, finance, retailing, mining, transportation, communication, to all work together to present government and the public with knowledgeable, timely information and with practical, positive suggestions for action. Only CEOs of major U.S. companies are members, and they head up and constitute many specialized committees. In the first half of 2000, the Roundtable's major public announcements centered on applauding Congress's passage of normal trade relations with China, opposing the Patients' Bill of Rights in Congress, complying with the SEC's request for views on international accounting standards, and opposing class action lawsuits. These are important issues, to be sure, but they also reflect a relatively narrow and technical perspective of the organization's mission. More effort is devoted to government lobbying than to thinking about a serious business role in shaping a national agenda. It's almost as if the Business Roundtable doesn't want visibility beyond the narrow confines of immediate legislation. Certainly, the organization doesn't envision a leadership model that departs from the existing pattern. Government leads, government is responsible, and business executives are confined to making their views known and trying to influence Washington's decisions. There is no effort among chief executives themselves to take the lead in identifying what exactly the government ought to be addressing, but isn't. There is no effort to identify what CEOs themselves ought to be doing independent of the government. None of the other business associations, like the National Associations of Manufacturers or the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, for example, has risen to the occasion either. At the beginning of One World, Ready or Not, his thoughtful book on the global economy, William Greeter asks his readers to close their eyes. Imagine a wondrous new machine, strong and supple, a machine that reaps as it destroys. Think of the awesome machine running over open terrain and ignoring familiar boundaries. It plows across fields and fence rows with a fierce momentum that is exhilarating to behold and also frightening. As it goes, the machine throws off enormous mounds of wealth and bounty while it leaves behind great furrows of wreckage. Now imagine that there are skillful hands on board, but no one is at the wheel. In fact, this machine has no wheel nor any internal governor to control the speed and direction. It is sustained by its own forward motion, guided mainly by its own appetites, and it is accelerating. No analogy is perfect, of course. Nevertheless, as the new century unfolds, Greeter's rudderless world economy will serve the interests of neither citizens nor business leaders. Herein lie some of the most crucial questions that CEOs face. To what extent are they aware that for capitalism and democracy to survive, society, including them, must find a way to ease the social costs of the free market economy? To what extent do they understand that despite the current prosperity, huge problems loom on the horizon, from a crisis-prone financial system to a rapidly widening income gap? To what extent are they prepared to step up to their contribution to economic, and by implication, political and social stability? To answer all of these questions is the same. As individuals, CEOs are aware and concerned, and they are trying to contribute in a way that they think they should. Yet as a group, they are too much on the margins of the big problems of the day. Chapter 9, Pax Americana. In May 2000, Novartis AG, a gigantic Swiss pharmaceutical firm, went public on the New York Stock Exchange. Until that time, Swiss firms had been reluctant to list themselves on a U.S. stock market because it meant adopting U.S. accounting standards and complying with the Securities and Exchange Commission's stringent information disclosure requirements. Novartis' chief financial officer explained to a Wall Street Journal reporter why the company had changed its long-standing policy. Quote, "To become a truly global player, able to attract the best talent in our industry, sooner or later, we'd have to play by the U.S. rules," he said. Novartis is one of the many foreign firms that have restructured their financial reporting systems in order to appeal to U.S. investors. This is a major change for such companies because it means making their internal operations transparent to the public. In contrast to the long tradition in continental Europe, Japan, and other non-Anglo-Saxon areas of disclosing as little as possible, the reason for this about-face is that America has the largest and most liquid pool of capital in the world, and almost everyone wants access to it. In 2000, for instance, foreign funds were flowing into the United States at a rate of $1 billion per day. Foreign companies want to use their U.S. shares as a currency to make acquisitions in the United States. Going public is good publicity as well and can contribute to American consumers' awareness of a foreign firm and of its products. In the last half of the 1990s, it was particularly a good time to tap into the market, given the high valuations, though the value for foreign companies to list their shares in America has been increasing over a decade. But financial prowess is just the beginning of U.S. power. Most CEOs believe that the influence of the United States, its political, economic, and technological clout, even its culture, is one of the most powerful forces acting on the markets. It would be impossible to understand the climate in which business leaders will be operating in the early 21st century without dealing with the implications of the Americanization of the world. But what exactly is this phenomena? Is it real and deep as it looks? To what degree should top U.S. executives be thinking about deliberate strategies to prolong American substantial influence over the world economy? And if they conclude that they need to become more proactive, what role can they play? My view is that as formidable as Americanization seems to have become as a force, its depth and longevity should not be exaggerated or considered inevitable. The popularity of American capitalism rests in a large part on the unprecedented business expansion over the last decade, a trend that obviously can't be reversed. It wasn't so long ago, after all, that Japan was widely admired for devising a system that promoted growth, innovation, respect for workers, and social equity. Then, when its economic bubble burst, and with it virtually all foreign confidence in the country's ability to handle its own problems, all this evaporated. We are making an assumption that the internet, invented in the United States and dominated for now by U.S. companies like Intel, Cisco, Microsoft, Oracle, will accelerate Americanization of the globe. Another scenario is that this new communications technology will give a greater voice to more groups who want to go their own way and more clout to minorities who want to preserve their own cultures and will be able to do so by linking up their disparate communities around the world into powerful ethnic networks that supersede all nationalities. In addition, many societies have grafted American capitalism onto deep-seated cultures with markedly different histories and priorities. While seeming to embrace Americanization now, these countries may in time reject the U.S. system, or at least major parts of it. History shows that empires bleed a degree of hostility in other nations, both friends and foes. Some of this resistance is becoming all too evident in Europe, Russia, China, and Japan. If U.S. CEOs thought about these trends, many would probably say, "The time frame is too long to affect me. Anyway, it's all too big and fuzzy for me to influence, maybe even too much for Washington." However, challenges to Pax Americana pose a threat to U.S. firms that is more imminent than it appears. Especially in the context of the general backlash against globalization, not to mention the inevitable inevitability of an economic downturn at some point. Besides, the U.S. foreign policy can count. Washington does influence how the world views the United States. Whether it finds Uncle Sam a congenial superpower, whether it is more or less willing to accept our notion of democracy and capitalism. If American CEOs recognize that, then they ought to yield more influence on U.S. foreign policy than they now do. They ought to seek more involvement not only in international economic matters, but also in U.S. statescraft. In the mind of the CEOs in the United States, there appears to be little room for such thinking now.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC. But it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which is looking at the future of the corporation, by Jeffrey E. Garton. And we're continuing reading the chapter, Pax Americana. There's ample evidence of the enormous influence the United States has had on the world economy. The predominance of U.S. financial markets is indisputable. Although the United States accounts for more than 25% of global production, in the last few years its stock market capitalization has hovered around 50% of the world total. And this is not the whole story. Markets everywhere are heavily influenced by what happens in Wall Street and Silicon Valley. They base their behavior on U.S. interest rates, on the patterns of securities trading, on the trends in venture capital, and the views and actions of the Federal Reserve, Chairman of the Treasury Secretary, can now influence markets from Sao Paulo to Shanghai. In the financial services industry, too, U.S. firms dominate the most dynamic businesses around the world, such as mergers and acquisitions, securities underwriting and trading, and financial restructuring. At the end of 1998, the Bank of Japan, equivalent to the U.S. Federal Reserve, called in McKinsey and Company to help it reorganize its management and systems. A year later, Merrill Lynch was called in to help with the consolidation of Fuji Bank. Daiichi Kengyo and the Industrial Bank of Japan, three of Tokyo's largest and most important financial institutions. In May 2000, when the London and Frankfurt stock exchanges were contemplating merging, a major milestone in European financial history, Goldman Sachs was the principal advisor to the German exchange, while Merrill Lynch performed the same function for the British. Finance is only one area where the United States casts a long shadow on the global economy. In the high technology area, firms like Cisco, Intel, Microsoft, and Oracle predominate. In media and entertainment, few foreign companies compete with Disney or Time Warner, or those that can, such as Sony, are able only to do so because they brought U.S. studios and operate from a U.S. base. More than companies of any other nationality, U.S. firms have brought their distinct management styles, their technology, and their cultures to foreign countries. In addition, U.S. universities have been importing some of the world's best talent and creating new generations of engineers, scientists, and MBAs, who have in turn spread their knowledge and skills well beyond the U.S. shores. In developing countries like France, Germany, and Japan, radical economic changes are occurring along the lines of the U.S. model, namely less regulation, more financial transparency, more accountability to shareholders, more mergers and acquisitions, more entrepreneurship, more flexible labor markets, and so on. For the first time, many foreign companies are focusing on modern corporate governance, which makes companies more accountable to private citizens who owns the company's stock. In Germany and Japan, the cozy system of companies holding one another's shares is breaking down, creating, as a result, agile corporate structures. In Germany, workers' participation in management boards, a major feature of the country's post-war economic structure, is declining. In Japan, the system of lifetime employment is gradually ending. In France, the state is shedding its own ownership stakes in such industries as air transport, banking, insurance, and telecommunications. It would have been unthinkable just a few years ago for Europe to have been the scene of gigantic takeover battles such as occurred in 1998 and 1999 when Oliveri acquired Telecom Italia and Britain's Vodafone AirTouch bought Germany's Mannesmann. One powerful force opening these economies is the Internet. Invented, inspired, and driven by Americans, and the ultimate creator of new and more democratic markets. In Japan, known for its cultural rigidities, the Internet has allowed housewives to come together to start businesses. It has opened up opportunities for employees in big companies to bid on other jobs within these companies, outflanking the rigid hierarchies. In Germany, entrepreneurs have become a new corporate heroes, replacing the CEOs of big established companies. Many countries have many similar stories. In emerging markets, the U.S.-style changes are equally dramatic. The lowering of trade barriers, encouraging foreign investment, privatizing state-owned companies, stepping up banking and securities regulation, devoting more attention to sound corporate governance, establishing modern bankruptcy laws. Here are just some of the measures most of the countries in Asia, Latin America, and Central Europe are taking. Here, too, the tightly woven ties between government and business, the links among big businesses themselves, are breaking apart with increasing speed. The U.S. system does, in fact, have features that suit it to deal with many of the kinds of changes that we now observe to be sweeping over the world today. In the early 21st century, corporate competition will be based more than ever on such factors as the effectiveness of a country's regulatory systems, including the balance between markets and government intervention, the environment for scientific research and technological development, the system for educating, training, and management of every workforce, and the openness of a society to change. On every single count, the U.S. has a commanding lead. The integrity of the regulatory structure, based on its transparency and legal protections, gives people confidence in U.S. financial markets. The fluid labor markets ensure that workers can move to where they can be most productive. The antitrust laws help create a level playing field. The educational research complex fuels new technologies. The willingness to accept immigrants in large numbers creates a steady supply of labor and skilled talent. All this fosters widespread entrepreneurism, a trait that is critical to succeeding in an era of rapid change. It's a post-industrial world, wrote New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. And America is good at everything that is post-industrial at this stage. Evidence of Americanization can also be seen in the minds of business leaders. CEOs from many different countries share a lot of similar ideas. They buy into similar models of leadership and strategy. They're equally obsessed with the internet and also with global strategy. And they are struggling to deal with some of the same daily management problems and to find the right level of involvement in the social and political arena. They are generally optimistic about the future, and while some worry about the backlash against globalization, either in the form of rising political and cultural nationalism or trade protectionism, they are proceeding at full speed. And if these trends will not seriously disrupt the momentum for a more open world economy. These similarities among business leaders may not seem surprising, but they represent a marked change from the 1980s and 1990s, when perceptions were more divergent. Back then, many observers were critical of the U.S. model because it seemed to have lost its competitiveness, and they were touting Japan as the next global superpower. In 1992, for example, in a book entitled A Cold Peace, America, Japan, Germany, and the Struggle for Supremacy, I identified three quite different forms of capitalism. At that time, for example, German executives were promoting, quote, Rhineland capitalism, unquote, and pointing to the cooperative ties among their companies, their banks, and their labor unions as their keys to success. They claimed that their system was more stable than the U.S. one and allowed more long-term thinking and investment. Half a world away, Japanese CEOs were proud of their corporate links within families and firms called Kyitsisu, were more interested in gaining market share than in earning profits. They also touted the importance of being able to plan ahead and take advantage of what they called patient capital. We're going to be looking at this in more detail in future shows, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting